Well, tonight, I want you to turn to the Gospel of Luke. Go to chapter 22, Luke 22. And we are also going to look at John chapter 18. But we're going to begin and spend most of our time in the Gospel of Luke. When I was a little guy, my dad had a family reunion. It was up not too far from where my grandmom lived on my mom's side. But we drove, I guess, for 30 or 40 minutes over to, I think it was around the Uvalde area. That's where some of my dad's people were from. And of course, you know, when you're 9, 10 years old, you know, you're not really into the family as such. You're more into the cousins, you know. You want to find somebody that wants to play ball. But at that particular family reunion, there was something that just captivated me when I was just kind of minding my own business, just looking around, seeing what was happening. There was a great uncle of my dad. And what captivated me was the fact that he didn't have an ear. His ear had been taken off because he had cancer in it. And as a kid, I mean, I was always taught not to stare. All right? Anybody was ever in here taught not to stare? All right? Well, I was staring, but I was trying not to get caught doing it because I had never seen anything like that. I mean, you're looking at the side of a man's head, and it's slick except for the hole that's in the side of his ear or side of his head because the ear's gone. And, I mean, I'm cutting it out of my corner of my eyes. You know, I mean, I'm trying to get into an angle where I can kind of look straight on because I'm fascinated with this. And here I am. I'm 62 years old now. This had to be at least 52 years ago. And I still remember seeing that great uncle of my dad's with no ear. Tonight, there's a man that had an ear, but it was cut off. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. This is the 36th miracle of Jesus. We started this months and months ago. And on Wednesday nights, we have taken a miracle most of the time in sequence. And now we're down to two. And tonight, I have entitled this message very simply, Malchus's Ear. And you'll know why we know the name here in just a few minutes. I want you to look with me at Luke 22, and I want you to look at verse 47. It says, "And while he yet spake," now Jesus is who they're talking about. So what is he speaking about? Well, he has gone and he has been praying after they have left the upper room. The only time that you ever see Jesus in a room in Jerusalem is in the upper room, and we find him only once there. Most of the time, Jesus usually slept outside of the city. We mentioned whenever I was preaching on the resurrection of Lazarus that often he would stay in the home of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. And so he was in the upper room. And Judas has left. He has gone to put the plan, the conspiracy, in motion. So we see, first of all, that the stage is being set. Now, what do you have Jesus doing? He leaves the upper room. He goes across the Kidron Valley through the Brook of Kidron. And in the springtime, it's begun to dry up. It only really is a is a real, I guess, swift moving brook when the winter rains come. But by the time spring gets there, it has begun to get lower and lower and lower, and in the summer, it's just dry. And so they've walked across this brook of Kedron up into the Mount of Olives, and as he is there, he leaves the majority of the disciples, with the exception of the inner circle, Peter, James, and John. He takes them a little farther up into the garden, and he begins to pray, and they begin to fall asleep. And of course, you know the story, how that Jesus is praying in the garden, and he's praying, "Lord, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." And he's praying this prayer, and he comes and he says, "Could you not watch and pray?" And then he goes back and he prays some more, and they fall back asleep. Well, finally, after he has prayed and he's done praying, he begins to talk to the disciples once more. And evidently, the inner circle now is back with the other disciples that have been left, maybe at the first location as they started into the Mount of Olives. And so he begins talking to them. "Why sleep ye? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation," a time of testing. Well, and as he's telling this, as he's talking, "Behold a multitude. And he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them." So the stage is set. He has finished praying. He is talking to the men. "Couldn't you pray? There's going to be an hour of temptation." And then, as they're standing there at the Mount of Olives, they can look down and see the valley and going back up toward the city. And coming from that city is a multitude. Over in the Gospel of John, it's called a band, B-A-N-D. The Greek word for band there is a military term called a cohort. And so what has happened is the Jewish authorities, the Sanhedrin, they have got Pilate to give permission for the Roman soldiers to send part of their force from the Fort of Antonio. They have got these men that are going to be coming to arrest Jesus. So you've got Gentiles, which are Romans, and you've got Jews with their police force, and they are coming all together to the tune of possibly 1,000 people. It's not going to be hard to see them coming, because they're coming with their torches lit, and it's the time of Passover, so the moon is full. And so as these apostles, they're looking, and they're looking toward Jerusalem, and they see that fire trail as it's moving. And it's going down through the valley of Kedron, and it's coming up to where these guys are at, and they know something is happening. And so you've got Judas, who is one of the apostles. He's the one that's leading the pack. Now, why is he leading? Because he knows where Jesus goes. This is not the only time that Jesus has retired to the Mount of Olives. There are some people that surmise that the man that owned this property gave Jesus access to it anytime that he wanted. Some people even make the assumption that the writer of the Gospel of Mark was a member of a wealthy family, and this was Mark's family that actually owned the garden. Now, that's all speculation, and that's all some commentator from years ago. That's what they think. There's nothing scripturally that will, I guess, prove that. But we do know that Jesus spent a lot of time praying in that secluded place of the garden, and these apostles knew exactly where he would like to go. Possibly there was a rock where he could sit, and he could lay his hands upon that rock And it would be comfortable as he was talking to the Father. And so Judas knew where he was at, and he went before them, and he drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. And of course, the kissing there is a kiss on the cheek. In the Eastern cultures, they do that to this day. We have a fellow in this church, and every once in a while, when we're shaking hands, he'll want to hug me and give me a kiss on the cheek. And it's just kind of his way of doing things. And so, anyway, these Eastern folks, they would kiss people that they supposedly respected. There were times when people would have a rabbi that they followed, and when they would meet him, they would bow and they would kiss him on each cheek as a way of reverence. Well, this is the sign of the, I guess, of the traitor. In other words, he that I'm going to kiss, that's the one that you need to arrest. Now, the Romans, they probably didn't have any idea what Jesus looked like. Perhaps some of the Jewish police, perhaps they did, and maybe that's why they were at the front with Judas. And so we see that the stage is pretty much being set. And Jesus says to Judas, "Betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss?" In other words, I know exactly what you're doing. And when he said that, then we see something that begins to take place. Now the apostles, if you notice the little word "they" in verse 49, we see that the apostles are really kind of getting in tune with what's happening here. Jesus has been talking about dying, and they're saying, "No, no, 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 we don't want to see that." And so, as a matter of fact, they're thinking about fighting. If you doubt that, if you look back at verse 36, Jesus is talking to them, and he says, "But now he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." So perhaps these guys are thinking, okay, Jesus has not really been into fighting until now, but now he is ready. And so back to verse 49, it says, "When they were about him, Saul." So if you wanted to kind of clarify that, you could circle the word "they" and write out beside of it, "when the apostles were about him," right around Jesus, "saw what would follow, they said unto him, Lord, shall we smite with the sword?" Now to me, that's a little humorous, because you've got 11 men, but they only have two swords. You say, "Well, preacher, how do you know that they only have two swords?" Look back at verse 38. In verse 38 it says, "And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords." Well, Peter had one. It doesn't identify who was holding the other one. But they only have two swords among 11 people. And so they're saying, "All righty, do you want us to fight?" And before Jesus could answer, we see a sword that's drawn, and a fight is started. If you read, it says, "Lord," and one of them smote the servant. The word "servant" there is a slave of the high priest, and cut off his right ear. Well, Matthew tells this story. Mark tells this story. John tells the story, and here we just read it that Luke tells this story. So you've got all four of the gospel writers that tell the same story. And so what you've got is you've got a man that cuts the ear off of the servant. Now somebody said, "Man, he must have really been a good swordsman." Can I tell you, I think that he just missed? What was Peter's occupation? He was a fisherman. Fishermen are not known for their skills with a sword. Now, they may be known as skilled with a net. They had several different kind of nets. They would have one that you could cast by hand. You would have some that you would put out of a boat, kind of like a drift net type thing. Then they would have a drag net that would really go out deep. But as far as a skilled swordsman, I don't think that Peter was really practiced in that skill. I think what happened is, I think that he was just impulsive. And he wanted to just basically start killing somebody. And so, I don't know if he swung this way and Malchus ducked his head and it went right across and sliced it. Or I have a tendency that he came down from the top and Malchus did this and it went right by him and maybe hit on his shoulder where possibly some protection, maybe some of the armor would have been. And I don't know if the ear was left hanging on the shoulder, if it was left hanging by a piece of skin, or if it literally was lopped off and it was hanging or laying on the ground. The only thing I know is that the question was asked, "Lord, shall we smite with the sword?" And before Jesus could answer, Peter already had his out and was swinging. And so we see that he is wielding this sword. Well, when you come to verse number 50, and you see this act of Peter, the Lord immediately begins scolding him in the next verse. If you look at the next verse, it says, "And Jesus answered and said," and I'm going to be honest with you, the next four words are really difficult to kind of understand. And I don't care who you read, everybody's got a difference of opinion, what these words mean. "Suffer ye thus far." There's some people that look at this and say, if we were going to say it today, we would say, "Stop, enough of that." And then there's other folks that look at the word "suffer," and what it means is, it means to, please, give me permission, allow me to do something. Now, we don't see this from the Gospel of Luke, but if you read Matthew and Mark, you will find that Jesus at this time is probably already has his hands bound. And so it seems, if that's the case, that the second part of interpreting would be, "Please permit me to do this." Now somebody says, "What do you mean, permit me? Why would Jesus ask that?" Can I tell you that Jesus willingly submitted to what's going on here? They could not have done a single thing if Jesus had not allowed it. I want you to hold your place here in Luke, and I want you to flip back. I want you to see this. Go back with me to the Gospel of Matthew, and I want you to look with me at Matthew 26, and we will look, we'll start in verse 47. So flip back to Matthew 26, and I just want you to see this, because Matthew really nails it when it comes to the fact that Jesus willingly submitted. It was not something that anybody could force upon him. It was something that he was willing to do. He was willing to take that cup with all of our sins and all of our transgressions in it. I mean, as wicked can be. And he was willing to drink that and die on that cross. All right? Verse 47 says, "And while he yet spake, lo, Judas, one of the 12, came with him, a great multitude with swords, staves, from the chief priests and the elders of the people. He that betrayed him gave them a sign, saying, 'Whomsoever I shall kiss, that is the same. the same as he, hold him fast. And forthwith he came to Jesus, said, Hail, Master, and kissed him. And Jesus said unto him, Friend, wherefore art thou come? They came, they laid hands, and they took him. In other words, it's like they went ahead and bound him. And behold, one of them, which were Jesus, stretched out his hand, drew his sword, struck a servant of the high priest, and smote off his ear. Notice again, the name is not listed. All right? Jesus said unto him, Put up again thy sword into its place. In other words, there's a place for a sword, but it's not now. For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Now that is a truism that is still true today. But I want you to think about something in this situation. Peter is impulsive. We know that. But Peter also just recently opened his mouth at the first part of this chapter. And what did he say in front of all those other disciples? Jesus said, Peter, you're going to deny me. And he said, Oh, not me. I'm willing to go with you both into prison and to death. And so Peter may be thinking, man, I just opened my mouth. I better do something. Out comes the sword, and he starts whacking and cuts a guy's ear off. All right? And Jesus said, Put the sword up. Can I tell you that by Jesus having Peter put the sword up, he probably saved Peter's life? Who was there? Well, you've got the security force for the Jews, but that wouldn't be the one that I'd be most scared of. The one I'd be most scared of would be those 600 Roman soldiers, that cohort. Can I tell you that the Romans were expert killers? Those guys knew how to kill you, and they didn't mind killing you. And so you've got 11 men plus their master, and Jesus is saying, Put your sword up. And because of him saying that, he basically saved those 11 men's lives. And so he put it up. But this is the verse that I want you to really focus on, that Jesus was totally in control. Verse 53. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? Do you realize that that is 72,000 angels? But how then shall the scripture be fulfilled that thus it must be? In other words, hey, I don't need your help, guys. I'm doing what I need to do because this is why I came. So Jesus willingly lets them bound him. And if you doubt that he doesn't have the power to get away if he wanted to, all you've got to do is keep reading. And when you begin to read all of these stories, what you'll find is that they will say, Who are you? And he said, I am. And when he said that, just the sheer power of those words recoiled them. I mean, it blew them back. And they're falling. And here he is with his hands bound, just simply saying, I am. And back they go. And so he was totally in control. He is God, and there's no doubt about it. He told them one time, he said, I lay down my life, and if I wanted to, I can take it up again. He's God. And so you see that he is scolded. Now, let me just go ahead and pay this off before I forget it. I want you to turn over to John chapter 18. I want to make sure that you get this point before I forget it and I dismiss everybody. All right? If you look at John chapter 18, he protects them in verse number 8. I've told you that I am he, therefore you seek me. Let these, the apostles, go their way. He saved their lives. But then what I want you to do is I want you to look at verse number 10. It tells how that Peter drew his sword and he smote the high priest's slave, cut off his right ear, and it says the servant's name was Malchus. Why does the Gospel of John tell the name, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke not tell the name? Some of you may have an idea. Let me tell you what I think. I think that this story, I think that it had been written about in Matthew, Mark, and Luke well before the Gospel of John was penned. You see, if this story had been written and given Malchus' name early, it could have possibly put him in danger. It could have possibly put Peter in danger. But whenever you read it in the Gospel of John, Malchus may already be dead. Peter's already dead. And so, when the Gospel of John is penned, which is many, many years later than Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's no danger to these men. And so that's why most people think that John includes the name, whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke did not. And so you've got the man named Malchus. Now, there's different thoughts about did Malchus get saved or not. I personally do not know. I do know this. I know that in all the biblical scriptures that we have, there's never another time when Malchus is mentioned. We don't find him anywhere in the book of Acts. We don't find him anywhere in any of the epistles of Paul or Peter. We just don't find him. There is no references, according to the sources that I've looked at, in early church history. And so because of that, there's many people that think that Malchus was a recipient of God's wonderful grace. What did Jesus do? You've got an ear that's laying on the ground. Jesus' hands are bound. And what does he say? He says, don't forbid me, allow me. And they unloosen his hands. He quickly reaches down. He picks the ear up or takes it off the shoulder. And it's the touch there is not a light touch. He's holding it good. And he puts it back on the man's side of his head. And immediately, he's made whole. I mean, it is instantaneous. There's not any stitches that's got to be healed. There were no stitches. Now, if he had that happen and he did not get saved, he's a fool. Can you imagine somebody doing something that miraculous to you and you not even be affected by it? But there's something inside of me that says you can't get to a position that he had of being one of the top servants of the high priest and be a fool. And so I'm wondering how he continued with this group. Did he just kind of fade into the background? Was he constantly touching his ear to say, wow, I thought that was gone for good? So I don't know if he was saved or not. I hope that he was. And so you've got the Lord, and he shows great compassion. You see that back over in the Gospel of Luke. If you look at verse 51, it says he touched his ear and he healed him. And then it says Jesus began to talk to the chief priest and to the captains of the temple and the elders which were come to him. In other words, some of the leaders had come out. He said, be ye come out as against the thief, with swords and staves? In other words, you've got all of these swords. You've got these clubs. and you're coming out like you're going to beat me, like I'm stealing something? He said, when I was daily with you in the temple, in other words, when I was just walking around out in those courtyards, was I not there? What about last Monday? Do you remember whenever I turned the money changer tables over? Why didn't you take me then? When I came in riding that donkey on Sunday, why didn't you take me then? And he says, yet stretch forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. The power of darkness. In other words, evil is out at night. And can I tell you that evil seems to thrive on itself? This past Sunday, I preached on abortion. And I talked about the state of New York. I wrote about it in last Friday's blast. Do you know what came out today? The governor of Virginia. He has now said, I think that a mother ought to have the right to abort her baby after the baby has been born. Is evil not emboldened? And so you've got the people of Virginia now that basically have a governor that believes in murdering babies after they've been born. That's godless. That's demonic. We have a lady and her husband that's been visiting our church now for about a month. And we're really good friends with this couple. And the lady went into the post office last week and ran into one of our representatives. And she said, are you? And called one of the men's names, and it was the wrong one. She's like, no, I'm not him, I'm so-and-so. She said, and you know what, I knew that. Said, I remember seeing you and coming to one of your rallies, and I'm sorry I called you by the wrong name. She said, you should have been in church today and heard the preacher preach. He preached about abortion. And he made this statement. He said, well, he said, if you want to keep Georgia like it is, he said, you better get involved and you better start voting. We've got folks that are going to be really pushing hard in 2020 to change our state. And we got to be very, very vigilant. We need some of God's people to win somebody to the Lord. Because the only way that people are going to change is to have their hearts changed. And so we got a lot of evangelizing to do, folks. And we got a lot of preaching and teaching to do to get people to understand that right's right and wrong's wrong. And so you've got this compassion. And Jesus said, oh, now's your hour. It's the power of darkness. And what do? They take him and they lead him and they brought him into the high priest's house. If you ever take a trip to Jerusalem, you can go to Caiaphas's home. And it is the literal home. They found archaeological evidence, and it identifies it as Caiaphas's home. And in the bottom of Caiaphas's home, there's some rooms. One of them is a dark room, and at the time, you can only get in or out by being let down or up by a rope, and it was in total darkness. Now they've made a stairwell where that you can get down in there and you can put about 20 people comfortably, put about 25, and it's like sardines, and then they kill the lights and you can't see your hand right there. And that's where Jesus spent many hours before he was taken before Pilate. And then there's another room, and they've got ropes that are hanging from the ceiling where they would tie the prisoner and they would begin to beat him. And you can see that at Caiaphas's home. And then I want you to notice that it says, and Peter followed afar off. It wasn't but just a few minutes before, and this guy has a sword out, and he's thinking, I'm going to fight. But now all of that courage has vanished. And now fear is gripping him, but there's something inside of him that loves the Lord. And so what's he doing? He's following afar off. Now, can I tell you something? Those that were in the front of that crowd, they probably recognized Peter later on. Now, the ones in the back probably didn't. They probably didn't get a good look at him. But yet you've got this guy that's following afar off, and all I'm visualizing is he's standing there with his hands, and he's warming, and he's looking over at a distance. And all I'm thinking is he's got that turban on his head, but he's probably got some kind of scarf wrapped around his face. And the only thing he's seeing with is just, or open on his face, is the eyes that he can see with. And he's doing his best to see what's happening with Jesus. But he's not up there in the forefront with Jesus. All the courage is gone. So what do we take away from this? Well, I think that sometime as Christians, we need to realize that we don't need to fight. Can I tell you that we don't win the world with the sword? That's what the Islamists do. They conquer by the sword. Christians, we conquer by love. We're supposed to love people and let them see that they can have forgiveness through the Lord Jesus Christ and what he did on the cross. We ought to take courage in the fact that God is in control. Jesus, just by speaking the two little words, I am, forced them to fall on their backside. And they got up, shook it off, and he didn't do that again, but he could have. But he didn't, so that you and I could have salvation. And we also need to remember this, that there are times when we are courageous. But just having courage doesn't mean that we ought to be impetuous. There ought to be some zeal, but it ought to be with knowledge. And when it's time for us to be zealous, let's make sure that we do it, but it's tempered with self-control, knowing that we're doing the will of God and we're not doing it after the arm of the flesh. One of the things that I am doing my best to try to pray about is I'm doing my best to pray about letting the Spirit of God do the work and not trying to do it by human means. I'm doing my best to try to say, Lord, you promised in Matthew 16 that you would build your church. And Lord, don't let me and our staff begin to think of human methods. Let's make sure that we're doing what you want us to do. And I don't want us to take any step that's outside of the will of God. I want to make sure that everything that we do is in accordance with what God's will for this church is. So Malchus's ear, it got severed, but in the space of probably another minute, it was back. One of the smallest miracles maybe that Jesus ever did. But can I tell you that the greatest miracle that ever was performed would be performed in just about 3 days? You got Jesus that's going to come out of that grave. And the resurrection of Jesus is the cornerstone of Christianity. This little miracle gets lost in the shuffle. But I really believe that it meant a lot to old Malchus. It meant a lot to me if he'd have done that for me. Can I tell you that Jesus means a lot to me because he did more than just save my ear? He saved my soul. Let's stand together.